And welcome to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LP 106.9 Salida. And I've got another fine guest lined up this evening. And again, I want to mention that the views expressed on this program are those of myself and of my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And the program is streamed live on KHEN.org and as well as they're archived at www.gimmesometruth.info. And I'm just going to mention, too, that I could sure use somebody that wants to volunteer some help on some website work, just, you know, uploading a few things and keep maintaining the website. But if that's just in case anybody out there listening might be interested. But in the meantime, I have my guest, Ron Olford. And I'm going to let him describe his background, but he also has been working with a group called Trademark America. And I will let him kind of describe both of them when he gets comes up here. So, hi, Ron.
Hi, Melody. Good to talk to you.
And great to talk to you. And, Ron, I'm going to let you describe yourself and your background, and then we'll get into it. Because I think your experience and what you're dealing with fits perfectly in our vicinity, too. So go ahead, Ron.
Okay, thank you. Well, I moved from the big city to a rural community about 11 years ago, and that's when my eyes were open to really what some of the problems were that were going on with the federal agencies. My background had been in the science fields as a chemist, and then as a computer, in the computer fields, I had done a number of different things, programming and systems design and so on, but retired out to a small community in northwestern Montana. And like I said, my eyes were opened by some of my neighbors and people in the community who wondered what they could do to stop this federal encroachment on their rights to access public lands. And so I founded one organization, which we called Montanans for Property Rights. And we had some successes in fighting back zoning and land planning in our community. And then started to learn about some other ways. We tried a number of different things to combat some of these out-of-control federal agencies, but didn't have much success. Things like protests and demonstrations and petitions and appeals in court, lawsuits. All of these things didn't have much success. And then I learned about a process called coordination and have since then been focused on that process. And that's kind of what I would like to be talking about initially anyway, to describe what that is about.
Okay. And I'm just going to turn you loose here because this is where you have the expertise, and I just want the audience to hear kind of what you're dealing with because, again, like I said, this is what you're dealing with is what we're dealing with all over the country. So,
that's right. That's right. And the citizens they want some reasonable things like working economies with jobs and wise management of public lands, ability to use resources on the lands and access to public lands, etc. And we know what some of the problems are, which are restrictions on access, road closures and things like that, decrease in forest products resource use such as timber sales and minerals. There's an increasing array of federal designations of land all over the place. I have a list here of 22 different kinds of designations. I won't read them all, but everything from national cemeteries to ice age floods, national geologic trails, and national monuments. And if these things keep going, we're going to end up with more than half of the country being excluded from public, from human habitation. So, okay, what is the solution to this? Is there a way for ordinary citizens at the local level to have a real impact on federal government plans and actions? And if so, how can they have an impact? What we've found is that through the process of coordination, and it sounds like a simple word, but through the process of coordination, which can be defined and has a basis in law, can be used to give the local citizen a say in what happens in the public administration of lands and also other areas.
Do you want to go ahead and define that first before you get too far here?
Yes, that would be the next thing I should do is define it. The definition recognized by the U.S. Department of Justice, even, is being equal in importance, rank, or degree, not subordinate. And that's very important. We keep reminding ourselves of that all the time. And what it means is that local government and federal government are sitting at the table on an equal basis to achieve consistency. Okay, consistency with what? That means a consistency between local government plans and policies with federal agency plans and policies. And in a lot of cases, they start out being miles apart. So the objective is to be at the table to achieve consistency and also to require to really force the federal government to obey the law. And what we find is that probably 98% of federal decisions and actions are not according to law. There's no law that says they have to do certain things. It's all discretionary. So they can choose to close certain roads or not to close certain roads. And so if the local government has a seat at the table on an equal basis, then they can give their alternative that says, no, don't close these roads. These have historic uses, etc. That's just one example. And it does work that way. It's a little bit hard for many federal agents, employees of the federal government, to swallow that they're on an equal basis with a local government. They really find that difficult to take, and they don't really like it. But if the process is implemented properly, they're required to abide by it.
So you're saying that
even in court,
there is some kind of law written so that this is a requirement.
Yes, existing federal laws require all federal agencies to coordinate with local government, and there are some states that have similar law. And the basic federal laws are the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, and the National Forest Management Act, are the applicable ones generally in the western states. And there are others like the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and there's quite a list of different acts that also have the coordination language in it. The National Historic Preservation Act, the Homeland Security Act, and then there are executive orders that beef up coordination as well, Executive Order 12866 and Executive Order 12630. And then there's one that's very recent, a year ago, and that is Executive Order 13575. But I can get into more of those details as we go along here.
So how did you get into this, getting involved with this coordination aspect and paying attention to what is going on? What is it that made you...
I heard a presentation given by a gentleman from Maine who talked about about this process of coordination and pointed out the laws that, that backed it up and so on. So I started doing some research and learning about this, and then met up with an attorney by the name of Fred Kelly Grant, who had really developed the process, saw it in the laws, and spent about the past 20 years really testing it, proving it out in many different places. So he's had the most experience of anybody, and I traveled around with him, went to seminars, training under him, and so on, to learn more about it. Because what I initially found was that none of the things that we were trying was having any success, as I mentioned before. They just weren't producing anything, any real success at stopping some of these federal actions. And coordination has proven to be effective. There are many examples of counties and other units of local government that have had success in implementing coordination. So it's the success stories, of course, that got me convinced that this is what we needed to promote and encourage local governments to get involved with and implement.
Okay, now, would the person that did the presentation, would that have been Michael Kaufman?
That is the one.
Okay. And yes. And he has a great presentation on the net called Taking Liberty. But in the meantime, your reasons for getting into this coordination aspect is, if they're not coordinating, are they intersecting and conflicting? What is it that spurred you on there?
We could see very, very clearly by the actions that we had taken with using the standard process that the federal agencies wanted us to use, which was submit public comments. Okay, so we'd submit public comments, and they were always ignored. Completely, they were listed as an appendix to their documents, but never used in any meaningful way. So that was a frustration. And then filing appeals wasn't working. They just don't have the respect for public opinion. They don't want public opinion, and so going down that route of cooperating with the Forest Service or whatever federal agency it is, Bureau of Land Management or EPA or whatever, it just doesn't have any effect. But when you are at the table on an equal basis, if you establish that, and like I said, they have to recognize that you are there on an equal basis, then what you say has to be incorporated into their plan, into their planning.
So in other words, you're getting around, it isn't, when they ask for public comment, what you're really doing is saying, you know, no, we're not just public comment. We are here at the table and being able to implement, to design and be there for the implementation.
That's exactly right. That's a really good way to put it. We're not here for, in fact, interesting that you bring that up, because inevitably what these agencies tend to do, and I've been at many of these coordination meetings, conducted them, and what they will try to do is deflect the meeting, the process of the meeting, into this public comment kind of scenario. And in meetings that I conduct, I do not allow it. It's just absolutely, it is not allowed, because once they do that, it destroys the coordination. They want to do that because they don't really want to be in coordination with the local government. So we just don't allow it.
So if you had, say, like an art project or something, and it's not that I have an opinion one way or the other, but instead of waiting for the EIS and all the different agencies to come out in favor or against, the people would be there in the process of being able to have a say. It isn't just an afterthought.
That's correct. In fact, in the regulations that apply to coordination, this is in federal law. They are required to bring the local government in at the earliest stages before there's even a document written. Now, they never do that, but they're required to. And if the local government has initiated coordination, then they can say, okay, what do you have in mind? What are your ideas for the future? Even before they are on the drawing board, and they can be involved right at the very earliest stages. That is way different than the process they want you to be in, which is called cooperating agency status. In that, you come in way late in the game, and you really have no say, and you can't disclose it. What you learn there to the public, it's a very closed situation. So the coordination is very different than any other of these other processes that that you may have heard about and talked about.
So it is, I don't even know how you would get into this aspect of it, but often when these presentations are given to the public, they bring in, you know, these experts from out of the area, and they do these roundtables, and then somebody gets to take and coordinate all the opinions and aspects that they ask the people at these roundtables to submit.
That is a process they like, and I'm sure you've heard of the term the Delphi method.
Right,
it's been around for decades. And it's a method of controlling the decision. The decisions are made actually before the meeting starts, and there's a pretense in these roundtables of receiving public opinion, but that doesn't really happen.
But my opinion is what they're doing is they're taking their opinions and they're finding out how to overcome the objections.
That's right. That's the training that they have, and if you know that going into those kinds of meetings, you can do a pretty good job of fouling up their plans. It's not too difficult to do if you know what's going on. But that is totally different from a coordination meeting.
Which is like you said, on an equal basis, and where you can really be there at the table while these things are being drawn up.
That's right.
Now,
yes.
So where this might help is in the process of, say, you've got something going across the country as policy among, say, the Forest Service or other BLM. The local people can actually be at that table and maybe design their own program that is different from the others. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. A local government can, for example, write its own natural resource plan. It's not really necessary to do that. They can take a specific issue and say, we want to coordinate with you, federal agency, on this specific issue. I've been involved in many of those, and there was no prior detailed plan written by the local government, but just a written document that described the issue that they wanted to bring to the table, and there's no fixed method from the federal law that dictates how this is done. The only parameters around it are that the local government initiates it via a letter to the federal agency, and then the federal agency comes to the table. The meetings are conducted by the local government. They are in control of the meeting, and they bring the issues that they want to the table. And they ask the federal agency to provide information. They ask questions. They do research and bring this to the table. And then they will eventually produce what their expectations are for resolving this particular issue, that whatever issue it is. And then these negotiations go on, and the federal agency changes its policy. I've seen this happen dramatically, where they come in with, this is what we're, a real bold statement. This is what we're going to do. We have to do this. This is required of us. And then when they're challenged on, well, show us where it's required. Show us the citations of law that requires you this. And then they can't do it. And so they back down and they say, okay, well, we'll change it.
So in other words, it's they're first mandated by whoever to try to see if they can get away with it that way, right?
Right, yes. Okay. I think it all flows down from above. There are certain ideas of how things should be done, and they don't really want to have an act of Congress to do it, so they just, I think the higher-ups write a memo and say, we need to do it this way. And, of course, what are the people down the line going to say? You know, they're not going to say, no, I don't think we should do it that way. They're going to say, yes, sir, and they're going to try and implement it. But then when they're challenged to prove it according to law, they can't do it.
Okay, I'm speaking with Ron Olfert, and he's been working with trademarkamerica.org. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, trademarkamerica.org. But you also have been working on this coordination effort. And now, is that with Trademark America as well?
As well, yes.
Okay.
Some of it has been with Trademark America and some not, more or less on my own. It just depends. So, mm-hmm. You know, I'm available and whether it's through direct contact with me or through Trademark America.
So do you want to give your email address or anything in case somebody wants to contact you and see if, you know, you would
sure.
like to participate? Okay. Go ahead and give it.
It's R-O-L-F-E-R-T at blackfoot.net.
R-O-L-F-E-R-T at blackfoot.net. And that's how people can contact you in case they have questions or have a situation that might work with this coordination effort that seems to be a little more effective than the normal procedure that seems to be happening. And we see it quite often. I can't tell you how many times I've seen it where they come to the public and say they're going to take public comment, and it doesn't go anywhere.
Right. And I can also give my phone number if you don't mind that.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, it's 406-396-0022.
406-396-0022?
That's correct.
Okay, and that's Ron Olfert. And so, Ron, I mean, there's a lot of areas, and we kind of briefly chatted yesterday on some of the areas that you wanted to cover. And with this coordination plan, where have you been successful with this?
There have been at least 100 counties, well, local governments. I'll broaden it to that degree because it's not just counties. It can be invoked by any unit of local government, which could even include special districts like irrigation districts, conservation districts, water districts, and so on. And some of our examples that I like to talk about are one right here in Montana with the Glen Lake Irrigation District that has had success in seven different particular issues with the Forest Service and with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, in where they were trying to restrict access to the water for their irrigation district. Another one is, well, the first one that was proven out was in Idaho, Owyhee County. The BLM was, in conjunction with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, was trying to eliminate ranching in that county by reducing the water for grazing by using a proposed endangered species. Well, through coordination, the Owyhee County Board of Commissioners stopped the species listing. And they also forced Idaho Power, this was later on, years later, they forced Idaho Power to keep the power lines on public land. So they thereby protected private property. They've been implementing coordination since 1992. And in California, Modoc County has stopped species listings. They have maintained forest harvest where other counties have seen the decline dramatically. And they have stopped road closures. And they've been implementing coordination since 1993.
So are you saying that, I mean, because this is happening and you're having successes, but it seems like there's a whole lot more places that are under the gun of this that don't seem like they know about it or understand it? Or is there any reason why you think that that's happening?
Yes, I do. There are some reasons. The process it's actually very simple. It's a simple process, and I can go through what the steps of the process are, and you could say, and you'd say, well, that's very simple. But it's not easy. It does involve some work, and but there are ways to reduce the amount of work and the. And when you compare the amount of work to the effectiveness, I mean, it's well worth it. I mean, why spin your wheels with something that is ineffective when you do have a tool that's effective? So we shouldn't really look at the work part of it as more as the towards the results part of it. And people, well, county commissioners, they get cold feet sometimes because they just, They're misled by people that really don't want to see coordination implemented because it confounds their agenda. So they will come to the commissioners and say, don't do it. We don't want you to do it. And so they have a choice, listen to one side or the other. And oftentimes they will listen to the other side. You know, we have those pressures. I'd call them political pressures of the various sides of the issue. There are groups out there that really want to turn all of the forests into wilderness, all of it. I mean, we know that because they've introduced bills in Congress to do that very thing, so that's not hard to prove. Now, those are the groups that go to the local government elected officials and say, we don't want you to do coordination, because they know that their agenda will be interrupted, and they don't want it interrupted. That's what they're in business for. You know, I'm talking about groups like the Wilderness Society, the Montana Wilderness Association, etc. Various groups where they're obvious their agenda is to reduce access to the forest.
Okay, now you said business of when you were mentioning them. So who would be funding them?
That's not difficult to track either. They're funded by all sorts of large foundations. I don't have the names of them off the top of my head, other than I know the Ford Foundation is one. But there are many foundations that have a lot of money that fund these groups. Another thing that has been happening over the last couple of decades is that when, for example, the Sierra Club goes to court and sues the Forest Service to stop a particular, let's say, salvage logging project, and they do this all the time. When they go and file that lawsuit, and then they get they're ruled in favor, they win that lawsuit, they get their attorney fees back, so that it doesn't cost them anything. So they have a $25 million fund in their Earth Justice Legal Fund, and they can tap into that and just keep regenerating it. So they don't; it doesn't cost them anything when they win these lawsuits. That's essentially because of the Equal Access to Justice law.
And what is that? How does that work?
Well, that allows a citizen or a group of citizens to sue the federal government, and if they win against the federal government, they get their fees paid. That's essentially what it boils down to. Now, unfortunately,
it's hard local
governments don't have the ability to retrieve their funds, so that doesn't really apply. That's why the Sierra Club and groups like that are able to continue with these lawsuits.
Okay, now when I was asking about funding, a lot of these organizations that you're talking about are also funded by corporations. Because I've viewed meetings on an international basis where these corporations are being highly encouraged to affiliate themselves with non-governmental organizations, right?
Well, that's true, and I can think of one example for a very large international company in the wood products industry. Sided with environmental groups to eliminate the competition. So there's all kinds of reasons like that they might fund an action against the Forest Service or something because for their own gain.
Okay, and one of the things that's come up with some other groups that have dealt with, I mean, the Sierra Club or some of the EPA or whatever, their comment has been that, they're not consistent in how they go about it. They seem to be selective. So when you have a situation like with the Navy off the coast and the Northwest coast, being able to do this testing with weapons and chemicals that will affect the wildlife, they seem to be absent. But they kind of show up in these other situations. Are you aware of that one, Ron?
Yes, I've heard of those situations, and that's an example of what I would call hypocrisy. And there are plenty of those examples around. That's it. I mean, I think they react to whoever's paying the bill, and so. But generally, they are being paid by foundations to carry out a certain agenda that the foundation particularly wants carried out.
Mm-hmm.
What the foundation's motivation for it is open to debate. But we can find all sorts of connections back to. Global organizations like the International Convention on Local Environment and Environmental Initiatives others that are actually part of the United Nations. So they're promoting an agenda, and that's how they're doing it is through the money, through the funding.
Okay, so what you're saying then is when people do start asking questions, they need to not just take the first answer and keep digging until they really find, where they, make sure they've peeled all the layers of the onion away to what may be behind what is taking place. Because there's usually an agenda behind it, right?
That's right. There usually is an agenda. And we can, these days it's not that difficult. If somebody takes a little bit of time to go out and get the information from their own documents, it is not too difficult. I put together a very large set of documents and information on this organization called ICLEI, which is really the current major source of our problems right now. I suppose you know that they just concluded the Rio Plus 20 conference in Rio de Janeiro again, 20 years after 1992 when they had the Agenda 21 document signed by all those nations. They had Rio Plus 20. They just finished that up.
Right, but this time when they did it, my understanding is it wasn't so. They didn't like publish their agenda. They were a lot more secretive about what they were up to, right?
That's true. They were secretive, but here's what's interesting. I went out to their website and I decided that I would sign up for their newsletter to keep tabs on what they were doing. So I've been getting, well, at first for the say 6 months ago, I was getting maybe one newsletter a month, and during the last month, I've been getting one practically every day. And in there, they have documents. They have links to documents that they're constantly producing. And if you read those documents, it's very revealing. They have training documents on how to answer objections. When you're in a community meeting, you're an ICLEI representative, and here's what you do. You go into the meeting, and you don't talk about global warming. You talk about climate change. You change all the words so that it doesn't alarm people. I mean, that's right in their documents. This is the training they give their people. So I'm not making anything up. This is stuff that anybody can get just by going out there and reading their instruction manuals, their manifestos. If you like me to read a quote, this is actually really current. This is like 2 days old. This is the ICLEI UCLG Manifesto.
Okay, and ICLEI stands for?
The International Council on Local Environmental Initiatives.
Okay, so you did say that earlier. All right.
The UN body. The city of 2030 will strive to reduce its urban environment footprint. It will aim to become more compact. We cannot afford to use more and more of the Earth's surface for low-density, resource-intensive settlements, in which mobility depends almost wholly on the car. The city will give priority to energy efficiency, to renewable energies, and non-polluting technologies. The city's government and the people will understand more clearly than ever the need to minimize and mitigate climate change and protect themselves from its adverse impacts. So, that's part of their manifesto. This is there's a lot more. But
they get around that with places like China. I mean, they're not doing that in China, right?
No, they're not doing that in China. This is in the U.S. Well, they claim that their effort is worldwide, but their target is the U.S. And they've got about over 600 cities and counties signed on to their program. And once a city or county signs on to it, they agree to adhere to their charter, which is all global warming centric and reducing their carbon footprint. It's all straight out of the Agenda 21 textbook.
Okay, now, and there's fees involved with this, being a part of it. And what's kind of happening in the process is they're kind of dissolving the boundaries around these and local control, right?
They are. This is what's so insidious about it is that they're reducing the boundaries by going directly to the local governments and cutting deals directly. They don't have to go through the federal government anymore through this or through the state government. It's just directly to the local governments, and they have them sign these deals, and then they have to report. The local government has to report every quarter as to how much progress they have made to achieving their lower carbon footprint goals. And so if they have higher density housing, that's an achievement towards the goal. And they're constantly pressured to move towards these goals. That's the way ICLEI works. That's what the agreement says. The local government has about 13 different elements that they can choose from in putting together their particular resolution. And they can choose a certain number, but then they have to have certain ones in there. So they've got all these rules set up where they lock them into this adhering to this global warming fallacy. And that's really what it is. They're required to agree that global warming is a huge problem. And it's not. But they, so once the local government has signed on to that, initially they say, well, there's no fee, it's free. But I've got a chart right here from ICLEI that is their fee schedule. And it goes from $600 annual membership to $8,000. So,
but that's kind of just like putting their foot in the door, because there's a whole lot of other fees that are starting to be implemented via this international organization, right?
Sure. They've figured out how to draw these local governments in by promising them things that they know that they're not going to deliver, and that they will charge them for if they do, but initially promising them that everything is free. And I've read these promotion documents where they say it's free. And then you read, and then I've talked to people who have said, but then we got a bill a year later for $1,200 or $1,700 or whatever. what's that all about? Well, to me, that's deception. Well, that's just getting your foot in the door, getting them to sign a contract, and then starting to charge them.
Right.
But the fee is rather a minor issue. It's
right.
The controls that are exercised upon the local governments and the people that are the real problem.
Okay, I'm going to state again that I've got Ron Olfert, who is speaking out about, you know, coordination and how, you know, local people can keep their foot in the door and control over their lands and resources by being at the table when these plans are drawn up, instead of just getting these public comment periods after everything's already been decided. Right? Did I say that right?
That's right. Now, something interesting happened a year ago. I mentioned it briefly. And that is that President Obama signed an executive order that mandated that all these 25 federal agencies that are listed in his executive order must coordinate with local governments and state governments and tribal governments, just like before, just like the 1970s when these other laws were passed. But in addition to that, he added another type of entity, which is a non-governmental organization. He said, and non-governmental organizations. So when I read that, I about fell on the floor. I said, that's interesting. What does that mean exactly? So I did some research into what is an NGO, non-governmental organization, and found that it has a very broad definition, so that any any citizen-based, nonprofit, grassroots organization centered around any issue, local, national, or international, that is not government, is a non-governmental organization.
Can I mention that somewhere along the line, tell me if I'm wrong here, but I understood these non-governmental organizations are UN sanctioned.
Well, that's what they would like you to believe. The concept was started by the United Nations, but the definition of non-governmental organization is not centered around the United Nations. That's kind of a misconception that people have, that it is restricted to United Nations organizations. It's not.
Okay.
I don't know that it
had to be United Nations organizations, that they just had to have their approval.
They don't even have to have their approval.
Okay. All right, good.
And that's why we did the research into that definition, because the executive order, if you search the federal code, the United States code, you will find the term non-governmental organization in there, the small n, and it's just it complies to the proper definition of non-governmental organization, NGO. The United Nations use of that term has kind of overwhelmed any other consideration. And when people generally think of NGO, they think of a large international organization, but it doesn't have to be that way. For example, in India, there are I read that there are about 30,000 NGOs. Most of them are very, very small grassroots organizations, and they have nothing to do with necessarily the UN. They're just based on some particular interest that they have, each one. So, for example, the organization that I founded here in Sanders County, Montana, we call it the Sanders Natural Resource Council, and it's an NGO by any definition that you want to find. It is an NGO, and that's what we have initiated coordination on that basis, and we've been doing it successfully.
Being an NGO also enables you to be able to go to certain meetings that might be exclusionary otherwise, right?
Well, I suppose that would be true. I mean, what we did was we just said to the Forest Service, we're an NGO. We're under the authority of Executive Order 13575. We are requiring that you come to coordination. And they did it. And we gave them the basis in law. And they have come to the coordination table. We've been coordinating on various issues for the past 7 months or so.
Great. So now when you're talking about different aspects of these coordinating, I mean, like when you have a policy of going across the country of possibly cutting the rural roads in half, then the local people could speak up and say, no, we want these roads open. Is that what you're...
That's right. That's exactly what we did in a number of places. But one example is Glen Lake Irrigation District. They wanted to close a large number of roads. So what we did was prepare a table. We first of all requested and received their geographical information systems files, the GIS files, which is their data that they base all their maps on. And we received that data, and we analyzed it, and we got a complete list of all of the roads that they wanted to close, and made a table out of all those roads. We got a bunch of local people together who had knowledge of the historic uses of those roads, and we checked that table off, each road, this is what it has been used for historically, and submitted that as an alternative to the Forest Service plan. And as a result of that, that whole project has been stalled for years. So that project that we were told right at the start of it that this project has to be finished, and I think it was about 3 months. Well, that was about 2.5 years ago.
So but you still have to stay...
Put a stop to those road closures.
Okay, so but you have to stay ever vigilant with it. Is that what you're kind of...
You do have to be ever vigilant, because now what they did was they took that proposal and just rewrote it into their new revision of the forest plan. But we could see that, and so we've objected to that, and now their forest plan is going to be stalled as well, because they went ahead and, you know, just tried to bring it in another way. So we're in coordination with them on their new forest plan at this time.
So if you're in coordination, then you're able to sit there and see their overall plans for down into the future that maybe not, might not be as transparent. Does that help any? You following what
yes.
I'm saying? Okay.
Well, we can see what they're planning to do. It's been absolutely amazing to me to see the power of coordination in the kinds of information that we're able to bring out. For example, minutes of meetings, telephone conversations that they've had with people, data that is contradictory. I mean, they'll produce two sets of data that contradict each other. And, of course, we don't mind receiving that kind of thing. Adds to our ammunition. But whatever data, whatever we've asked them for, they have produced. One time we asked the Forest Service, we wanted all of their maps and photographs from the time the forest was created in 03 or whenever it was. We want all of their maps and photos, everything they have. Well, you know, that's going to be a big task. Yeah, we know it's going to be a big task, but that's what we want. Well, lo and behold, they did it. They produced it. Some of them were just infrared images, but they scanned them in and they sent them to us. We received a whole bunch of this information that was very powerful in putting together our arguments against them.
Okay, now, one of the things what do you see, or what kind of information are they putting out there is why they're producing so many of these wilderness areas? Because I think people are under the assumption that these are put in perpetuity and that they will stay in that same usage. Are you seeing that that's what they have in mind, or do they have some other things that you're seeing come out of these coordination meetings?
The type of land, the land use management type that is in perpetuity is wilderness. Once it is into wilderness or any kind of congressional designation, then that's it. You might as well write it off. I don't know of any that have been reversed. Another one would be a national conservation area. That requires congressional designation. And so there's a constant effort to put more land into wilderness. Other land uses, though, can be changed. That is why we're resisting more land going into wilderness, because we know that once it's in wilderness, we're sunk. We don't have any way of getting it out of wilderness again. We feel that 192 million acres of wilderness is enough.
Okay.
And so we have all these wilderness proposals going on around us, and we're in coordination, we're saying, no, we don't want this wilderness. We have enough wilderness. We will not accept your wilderness proposal. And we can produce very good scientific information that shows that the wilderness proposed is not scientifically based. And so it's not really even in accordance with the Wilderness Act of 1964.
So what do you think then is behind this then? I mean, and are you saying that our resources in this country are going to be locked up indefinitely, or is there some, you're not seeing any way that they've worked around this?
Well, if we can keep it out of wilderness, we have a chance of changing it. Mm-hmm. So that's why we need to keep it out of wilderness.
No, but what I'm trying to bring up is how is it that that corporations or those who are purchasing areas of various national parks commons, would treaties supersede this, and possibly these wilderness areas might not stay that way? I know I'm kind of reaching here, but there's a reason why I'm going there.
There are treaties, and they kind of overlay these wilderness proposals as well, and that certainly complicates it. We don't know what we can do with treaties. We're dealing with one treaty with Canada right now that has to do with the major river here, the Kootenai River, there is a treaty with Canada that expires in 2024, I think. And when it expires, the Canadians could divert the river completely deprive northern Montana from a huge amount of water. I mean, they could do it. I'm not saying they will, but that's what they could do if this treaty is not renewed. So I don't know the another thing about, I'll just make a comment here about northwestern Montana. We live in the Northern Rockies area, and there are all of these overlaid programs or initiatives. There's the Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act, which is trying to be passed, which the environmental groups have been trying to get passed in Congress for about 20 years now. They haven't been able to do it, but that would lock up all of our national forests up here into wilderness. Then there's the Yukon to Yellowstone Conservation Initiative. Then there's the Crown of the Continent Initiative, and then there's the Winton-Wiedemeyer Wilderness Proposal, and they're all on top of each other. So we've got to keep them all at bay. Any one of them could lock up all of the land for forever, I suppose you could say.
And say, like, if you had water, something take place in dams or whatever, and it was in a wilderness area, is that a possibility? And if that dam broke, would they be able to, or had problems, would they be able to get in there and fix it? Is that kind of thing, like, restricted?
That is how it's restricted. There would not be any opportunity to fix a dam that broke if it was in wilderness. I don't know of any dams in wilderness, but of course roads are taken out so that they can create wilderness. Those, of course, can't be replaced. It's not just wilderness. Okay, we're dealing with another situation here, another program that has been brought in through the Forest Service again. It's called the Grizzly Bear Amendment. And
before you get into that, let me just say this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and my guest this evening is Ron Olfert, and you're talking about the Grizzly Bear Amendment.
Okay. Yes, Grizzly Bear Amendment to 3 forest plans, the Kootenai National Forest, the Lolo National Forest, and the Idaho Panhandle National Forest. And what it does is it places restrictions on access to huge amounts of the forest, 2.2 million acres of the forest. And what the amendment does is it sets standards that all of the projects in the future will have to strive to meet. So we need to stop the amendment now, or all of the projects in the future will be closing roads. And then they'll be saying, well, we have no choice. We have this set of standards that we have to meet, so therefore we have to close these roads. It won't matter what we say. So that's why we're undertaking this campaign here, to inform the public. We've had 2 meetings so far. We're having a third one on July the 10th in one of the towns here. And the Forest Service has not taken too well to our informing the public of what they're doing. They have really objected to that and have come out strongly against it. But the people are very interested in seeing what's going on, and they're saying, why hasn't the Forest Service told us what they're planning to do? In coordination, we were able to get them to admit that they had not contacted property owners who would be restricted on their private property because of this Grizzly Bear Amendment. It really alarmed people. It also alarmed realtors, who are now saying, well, how can we deal with this? If we have to disclose to a buyer that their property is inside a bear management unit and that their access will be restricted, you know, what buyer is be interested in signing a deal?
Okay, so this is kind of like... they're trying to get around the very thing that you're saying that you can do with the coordination, because if they pass this, you're saying that won't be on the table and you won't be able to sit at the table anymore. Is that what you're saying?
Our sitting at the table, if they get this passed, will be fruitless because...
Okay, right.
Because right. What they'll say is, well, we have this set of standards here, and this set of standards says that 55% of this bear management unit has to be core area, and that in the core area you can't have more than 0.5 miles per square mile of road. So we have to close these roads. We have the standards to meet. And we'll be sitting there saying, well, what we don't want you to close the roads, and it won't matter because they will have established that that rule or that regulation that requires them to have a certain density of roads.
Okay.
In there. That's why we're fighting it now. And what they're trying to do, they're telling the people that we aren't closing any roads. This is just a set of standards. So then we come right around and say, hey, but here's what your standards say. It says right in black and white that every, and I mean every project after this passes, must strive to had to be in compliance with the standards.
How did they get the name Grizzly Bear Act then?
Well, because it's a bear, because it was set up as bear management units. What they're doing is creating habitat for the grizzly bear and then bringing in bears from outside. So their goal is to increase the number of grizzly bears right in where private property is, and increase the population of grizzly bears to where it'll be intolerable for people, because grizzly bears and people just don't get along.
So ultimately, if they can get the people off the land, then they want to make, you know, ensure that they're going to be less likely to come back in because they can't defend themselves against these animals. Because even, I mean, are these animals, can you defend yourself against these kind of animals? Because I'm hearing that you can't really do it against wolves. Am I correct?
You're correct. They're even more aggressive than wolves. Wolves travel around in packs. A grizzly bear individual has no problem charging, attacking somebody. And this notion that, all you need to do is carry around a $50 can of bear spray, and that will protect you. For one thing, the bear spray is only effective at 25 feet. If a grizzly bear is charging you at 30 miles per hour, how many seconds does it take to travel 25 feet? Not very many. And so to get out your can of bear spray and try to hit that bear in the face with this fog that it produces and expect that is going to guarantee that you're not going to be mauled by the bear is kind of an illusion.
Okay, but are you able to utilize a gun against them then?
That's a good question. If you're in the Yellowstone National Park, you can't. Glacier National Park, you can't. I mean, theoretically, you're allowed to protect yourself with a gun on your private property. Sure, but if you do, you can be guaranteed that you'll be hauled into court, and it will cost you a couple of $100,000 to defend yourself. I have personal acquaintances who this has actually happened to. Guy that was mauled by a grizzly. He was guiding some hunters with bull hunters, and he told the one of the party to shoot the grizzly with the bow and arrow, and he did, killed the grizzly, and saved the guide's life. Well, he was hauled into court, and it cost him, like I said, a couple hundred thousand dollars. He got $100,000 of it back because he won the lawsuit. But what kind of a win was that when it actually ended up costing you a net of $100,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these examples are not, that's not an isolated example. There's a second one right in my area just recently. The first one happened about, I think, 15 years ago. And then another one happened here just 2 or 3 years ago. So grizzly bear attacks are not that uncommon. They happen every year. Now, if they introduce 4 times the number of grizzlies into this area that they have now, what do you think that the landowners are going to do that live on the borders and actually inside these bear management units? They've actually mapped inside to these bear management units private property. I mean, we received, this is another thing we did in coordination, is we got their GIS data files, which they did not publish. They did not publish these maps that showed the private property inside the bear management unit. So that's what we did. We took their data and we made our own maps out of their data and we showed it to the public. And that's where the public has really gotten interested.
Well, you know what you're doing here and why it's so important is when you're talking about Michael Kaufman and his presentation is that all these little things seem unrelated, but they're not. And that there is an agenda in the works in this country to get rid of private property rights. And to get the people off the rural areas into these cities, and
that's right. That's right, and that's why in my presentations on coordination, I start with this Michael Kaufman created map that you've seen, I'm sure, that shows all the red areas in the country, and that's the one that was presented to Congress that stopped the Global Biodiversity Treaty from being signed by Congress.
Because he did do that presentation in front of Congress. Right.
Yes, he
did. Right. So, and what they really want is to do whatever means it takes to get the people out of the areas, and deception seems to be a method that they don't have a problem with.
That's right. They want them out of the areas. When you look carefully, oh, here's something that people need to be aware of. This whole grizzly bear plan was created by a group called the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee, IGBC. That was formed almost immediately after the Endangered Species Act was passed and the grizzly bear was listed as a threatened species back in 1975. The group was formally formed in 1983, and it consists of, we've been told all along that this IGBC, oh, it's just a handful of scientists who are doing research. Well, that's not it at all. It is composed of the Bureau of Land Management district manager, the Forest Service regional foresters of the three regions, 1, 2, 1, 4, and 6. It also has three or four state government officials in it. It has two Canadian government officials in it. It is a government body, the IGBC. And what they were mandated to do, we just received, recently got a hold of their guidelines document. And they say right in there that their scope is the 48 coterminous states. So they're not just interested in the northern Rockies here, Idaho and Montana and Washington, but their aim is to use the grizzly bear wherever possible in the 48 coterminous states. And they're starting here. This is their number one target area. They have been working for 28 years. I'd say actually 37 years. Officially 28 years to get this grizzly bear amendment passed. They tried it once before in 2004, and it was set aside by a court. This is the second pass at it. They really think they're going to do it this time. And it is the poster child for their control of private property in and around the national forests. They're moving forward with it at breakneck speed. We filed an appeal back last December, and they have completely ignored our request for a face-to-face hearing. We've gone all the way to the chief of the Forest Service, Tom Tidwell, and requested his review, and he hasn't responded to us yet, but we're still asking people to call him, write and fax and email Tom Tidwell to convince him to give us a review. That's all we're asking for, is a chance to meet them the decision makers face to face on this amendment. And they've refused to do it.
Okay, so
all during that time, this is what kind of seems a little strange. All during that time, the last 7 months, we have been in coordination with the forest, but not in regards to the specific appeal, because the appeal is inside their administrative process. We did that just as a second avenue, so to speak, to make sure that we hadn't left any stone unturned. But all the while, we were in coordination and getting information that we could use if we ever got to sit down with them.
Now, do they have the same similar type legislation or enactments in Canada? Do they have a grizzly type thing?
I have some similar things, and I'm really not up to date on the Canadian law. But yes, they're working together with Canada because, like I said, there are the British Columbia government and the Alberta government both are members of this IGBC. This IGBC should be called an international organization. Rather than interagency, it should be called international, because it's not just the U.S. agencies involved. It's also Canadian governments. So they're all participating in this.
Okay, so now if you have the Grizzly Act, what about the areas that they've already introduced the wolves? How does that work? Are those people being able to address, you know, protecting themselves with that? Or do they go through the same type of process where they have to, you know, pay, if they have to kill a wolf, do they have to go through court?
Well, the wolf is actually a little easier to deal with right now than the grizzly bear because they don't that's the difference. They did not designate these wolf protection areas. They didn't create wolf habitat, and they didn't create wolf management areas. They just protected the wolf wherever it was, and then now they have delisted it. So now people can go out and hunt wolves.
Oh, okay.
Cannot hunt a grizzly bear. And see, that's this is the insidious part of the grizzly bear program, is that it creates habitat. No matter if they tell you that it doesn't, it does. It creates habitat. And let me tell you the problem with habitat creation. Creating habitat does not mean there ever had to have been a grizzly bear anywhere in the vicinity. It's the theory that if there was a grizzly bear, he would like it here. That's the best way I can think of to express it, the philosophy of this habitat creation.
Wow.
I've heard it said in court, if there was a black-backed woodpecker in this area, it would like it here. Have you ever seen one? No, but if there was one, they would like it. This is good habitat.
So it's kind of an indefensible thing against the property owner then, or anybody that has reason to utilize an area, because they can pull these things out of their hat anywhere, right?
That's right. They can pull it out of the hat anywhere and create that habitat wherever they want to. And then after they create the habitat, okay, they draw a line around a certain area and they say, this is grizzly bear habitat. In this case, it's called bear management unit. And then they say, well, we don't have any bears in here. Well, how are we going to fix that problem? Okay, we'll go to Yellowstone, we'll capture a couple of bears there, and we'll dump them off up here. That's exactly what they're doing.
Wow. Okay, now we talked a little bit about land trusts and some other designations, and I'm wondering if you would like to talk a little bit about that with my radio audience here. And
well, yes, what you're talking about is, the land trusts were set up to acquire land through conservation easements. That's what they do. And what they do is they offer the landowner cash to cash them out of their ownership, and they say, "Oh, but you can still live on the property according to the terms of this agreement, and you can still do agriculture on it, and you can still do whatever you've been doing on it. But of course, you can't build any new buildings. That's number one. And then there are a few other things that you can't do, but you can still continue to live on it." So the farmer then, or the rancher, says, okay, that sounds good. I'll take my $30,000 and I'll live on my land. Well, he finds out very soon, within a few years, that he just can't make it on what he's doing, so he wants to change his program a little bit. Well, he can't do that. There's always a third party. This is the thing that the land trust doesn't tell the prospective seller of the conservation easement. There's always a third party that comes in to monitor the land under the conservation easement. That third party generally is somebody like the Sierra Club that comes in and says, "We don't like the way you're treating the land." And so they can change the rules in the middle. And And since the conservation is in perpetuity, there's no way out. The landowner cannot get out of it.
You know,
so he ends up having to leave because he can't make it on there, and he doesn't own the land anymore.
But is there something binding the third party to utilizing? Can they change the usage?
The third party doesn't change the usage. The third party does the monitoring. It goes back to the land trust and says, we find that the landowner is not treating the land right.
Okay, right. But say like the person that landowner, you know, now gets out of the deal. He doesn't want, it doesn't help him, so he moves on. Are they still bound to keep that usage in the future with third party and whoever does come back in?
Well, no, they can. The land trust can end up owning both ends of the contract, and when they do that, they just own the land outright. Then the thing just dissolves, and they own the land. And
okay,
that's
so then they can do what they want with it, right?
Right. The Nature Conservancy has acquired tremendous amounts of land that way.
Right. And so these resources and things like that then can be turned around and utilized or sold off.
Sure. That has happened where conservation easement that was supposed to be for the protection of natural resources or nature ended up being a big housing development for somebody that just wanted to make a big buck on the land, and it totally went against the original intent of the conservation easement.
Okay, and that so there, this is the kind of thing that I foresaw coming down the road. And I think they've just begun with this because there's so much incrementalism that's been going on and taking the use of our lands out of the public's domain. Because how much do they claim is private at this point? And if they start turning these private lands into conservation easements, and they're no longer in that public. I mean, where they can buy it or use it, right?
Right. The landowner does incrementally lose control of that property. There's the argument that I've been given to my face by the county commissioners is there's nothing wrong with conservation easements because it can be anything you want. It can be anything that the landowner wants. And so my question right back to them was, well then, what makes it a conservation easement? If it can be anything you want, what makes it a conservation easement? So they're a little bit stumped by that, and then I'll answer my own question. And that is, number one, it restricts the use of the property in some way. It restricts it to whatever is currently in use. And number two, it's in perpetuity. Number three, it's a loss to the inheritance, the heirs of the property. There's no more inheritance. And number four, there's always that third party monitoring that goes on, and usually they don't even recognize that. They don't even know that that's there.
Can I throw another aspect in here, too? When you start messing around with those kind of things, what does it do to the tax base?
That's another big issue, and I've gotten in arguments, and I've won every single one of them with the people on the other side. They say there's no difference. There's no tax impact. Well, how can that be? Because the property changes in value with the easement. I know of properties that the owner, after he sold the conservation easement, he tried to sell the property and couldn't sell it. couldn't sell it for any amount of money because nobody wanted the conservation easement. So it's an encumbrance on the property. So it reduces the value of the property. So all right, so if the value of the property is reduced, the county, you know, in their property assessment, they can use the method of comparable properties. They can use all sorts of different methods of determining market value. That's what they try and determine is market value. So if the market value is decreased, obviously the tax bill decreases. And therefore, the taxes of the non-encumbered properties in the county increase, has to make up the difference.
No.
And, I mean, they can't deny that. They can't deny that logic. And, in fact, I have plenty of citations of documents of people actually stating in different parts of the country that the reason they went for the conservation easement is because they were convinced that their taxes would go down, which, of course, they ultimately did. If the taxes don't go down, it's the fault of the property owner, not the county, because that property owner would have plenty of justification to go in and say, my taxes are too high because my property values have decreased. And they would have a case, and they'd be able to get their property taxes reduced.
Now, are they able to trade any of these conservation easements? Have you seen that process take place? Say, like...
I've heard of... I don't know if this is exactly trading the conservation easement, but they've traded the tax credits in certain cases,
mm-hmm,
allowed by a state. They've traded those around. Those are like cash, I guess. So I don't know about trading conservation easements themselves. I've never heard of that.
Well, I mean, if you're stuck with a piece of property, then you can't do any sell it. But you found somebody else that was in the same position that might trade. I wonder if that's even possible. And
I wonder if it is, because I don't know if those are transferable. They're not transferable to heirs, so I don't know if they'd be transferable to somebody else.
Okay, but if they were that third party guys, then that might change the
area. Well, that see, this conservation easement business is actually, if you look into it, it is an IRS program. I mean, that they have it's the IRS that has the rules around what the land trust can and cannot do, and what the easement seller can and cannot do. So there's all sorts of rules in there.
Mm-hmm.
If you read the Internal Revenue Code on that.
Okay. Again, I've got Ron Olfert, and he is with Trademark America, and he also has is working with coordination with various agencies so that people can come to the table with your various agencies long before they come go through public comment periods. So I know I'm throwing out a lot of what ifs and wherefores and whatever, but I've watched a lot of things. When these popular programs come out, all you hear are the good things. And yeah, you might hear a few negative things here or there, but it's down the road. If you're not, you can't reverse these things once you get into them. And they send a lot of hard sell salesmen out to push them, particularly if there's somebody that's going to stand to gain by it. And if you have, again, a program where it isn't just national but internationally, where they want to take away private property rights, that's what this country was about, was private property rights. And
that's right, and
so many people I run into think that this globalization thing is such a wonderful thing, but they don't realize it's about not having private property.
That's the essential thing. If we lose private property, we have lost it all. If we lose the right to own and control property, we've lost it all.
Then there is no difference between us and any other place in the world. And, you know, and again, that sounds fine and dandy to many, but those people don't have a voice at the table, and we won't have it either if we let it go.
Well, what's encouraging is that more and more counties and now groups are seeing the light, and they are wanting to do something. I've helped a number of counties get started in coordination, and they're very happy about that and plan to, they're very enthusiastic about continuing on to meet with the federal agencies. And we've talked a lot about the Forest Service and a little bit about the Bureau of Land Management, but in reality, the laws are broad enough that it covers all federal agencies. It's not limited to the land management agencies. And for one of the big ones that it really applies to is the Environmental Protection Agency. Now, every part of the country is impacted by the Environmental Protection Agency. You know, they have these rules that they're always coming out with. One of the latest ones is called the Boiler Max, which is the maximum allowable. What does CT stand for? I can't remember. Concentration something. Another kind of other rules that they're coming down with frequently. So coordination can be implemented there. It is especially effective when there is a proposed rule or regulation. And so when these proposed rules, like the Boiler Max rule or others, come down, the counties can invoke coordination and say, this is going to be damaging to our economy. You need to do an analysis of the effect on our economy, and you have to do what is called a Regulatory Flexibility Act analysis, and if they do that, they're going to find out that they really can't implement that rule because it would devastate the economy, and that's exactly what these rules do. So we have tools like that we can use in coordination, like the Regulatory Flexibility Act and like the Data Quality Act. Those are just additional laws that don't have the word coordination in them, but they are tools that we can use in the process of coordination.
So you were saying it took you quite a while to kind of come up to speed on learning about this process or how to work with this coordination, right? Or was it easier?
It has taken me. Well, it didn't take me very long to see that this is the effective tool, and this is what we need to do. Then I wanted to experience it. I wanted to be involved in the implementation of it, not just from a theoretical standpoint, but from actually doing it. And so it maybe took me a year to really get my feet wet in it, and then from there on out, it's been growing and growing. So I mean, I've learned by doing and refining the strategies that should be used in implementing it properly. So I've developed some things, not just me, but I mean the people I work with. We have developed some things to really increase the odds that we will have success with any particular agency.
Go ahead.
And we have, what I found is, and this is when I go in to a county or a group and say that wants to do coordination, I really stress that they need to follow these rules, or it's going to be polluted or corrupted into a good old boy, sit around and talk kind of program where you will accomplish nothing. And that has happened. So you've got to establish the rules, and you've got to follow the rules. And so that's, sometimes that's not easy because the people from the agency, if they're clever enough, they will try and figure out ways to involve, to degrade that process into what we were talking about before, that public comment scenario.
So have we talked about all the things that we discussed yesterday, or was there some other avenues where we wanted to go, or do we want to go more in depth a little bit more into some of the designations? I do think we talked a little bit about your monuments and various designations and what that does to...
That's an interesting particular... situation off the coast of Washington. There's the San Juan Islands, and the Bureau of Land Management has some outcroppings of rocks that are mostly submerged in water that nobody wants. I mean, there's nothing you can do with them other than, you know, seagulls perch on them now and then. But the BLM wants to has been pressured into proposing that they turn all of their lands into a national monument, national conservation area, or national monument. So they're heading in that direction, and a property rights group there learned about the executive order. Of course, I had been talking to them about it, and they decided they wanted to initiate coordination and work with the BLM in changing their direction. So they did. They initiated coordination, had a meeting, and some very interesting things came out in that meeting. And it was, the indication was given that they would be willing to discuss a community-run plan to manage those lands if they were designated. Well, that's exactly what they wanted, so they're working on that. So even the first meeting, the way I looked at it, it was successful to some degree. And you don't accomplish success in one meeting. That's just not realistic. But that's just the start, and then you just continue. It might take you 3 months, 6 months, a year, depending on the issue, or longer to actually accomplish what you are set out to do.
Yeah, but do people find sometimes when you have these different agencies can come up with these programs that they could find themselves strung out a bit in trying to deal with these different agencies? Do they overlap?
Yes, they do, and you can get strung out. It's a constant effort in planning and changing your strategy to determine which agencies to bring to the table sometimes. Because here's a typical example: the Forest Service will say, "Well, we're not really in control of this situation. It's actually the U.S. Fish and Wildlife's fault that we have to do this," as in the Grizzly Bear Amendment, because it's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that enforces the Endangered Species Act. So then we bring the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to the table, which we did. We ask them, and they say, "Oh, no, it's the Forest Service that manages the land. They're the land manager, so you have to talk to them." So we have them both at the table then, and we say, "All right, both of you, what is it?" You keep working at it. You keep getting them to make a mistake somewhere.
Okay,
and they will.
Okay, so this can be applicable to water, right?
Yes, it can.
Okay. How about in areas where you might have a UN bioreserve or some kind of an international control factor? Are they involved in this? Can they? Would they be involved in this process at all, or is this?
Well, what I always look for, what we should look for, is the connection between the international body and a federal agency, because the laws apply to federal agencies. The fact is, there's always a connection, and it's usually the EPA. So I'll give you an example. We were looking for, okay, how would we deal with ICLEI, because it's a UN organization, all right? So we wanted to see, is there a connection between ICLEI and the EPA?
And like
is there
Port
a smoking
Port Collins
gun connection? So I did some research, and I found that ICLEI is promoting the EPA on its website all over the place. Something like, well, there's several hundred documents that say, the EPA is doing this for us, and the EPA is doing that for us, etc. So then we went to the EPA website to see what they said about ICLEI. And they're a little more cautious. There's 550 documents that refer to ICLEI, but they don't really say they're implementing ICLEI programs. So from the EPA side, we don't really have as strong a smoking gun as we do from the ICLEI side. However, I would say that there is a definite connection, so I wouldn't hesitate to bring ICLEI to the table on that basis.
And you have, I think there's like Fort Collins is a city in Colorado, and I think Aspen, and there's a number of other ones. It's not as prevalent in Colorado as it is in some other states, right? Do you have a
right?
Okay.
Well, and I have a complete list of the local governments that are part of ICLEI. It's in what's called the Copenhagen list. That's the name of that document, and it lists it's an interesting document if anybody wants to research that out, because it shows right there what the progress has been made. It's a constantly updated list that shows the progress made by all of these local governments in striving to their goals, whatever their goals were. I mean, it's a table. And so you can do a search by state and find out what local governments in Colorado or any other state are the governments.
Well, wasn't the last Copenhagen meeting kind of a, didn't they have some problems with that? I mean, it seems like some of the other countries are starting to get wise to what the agenda is here.
Yeah, they are. They're having problems. They had problems with the one that just ended, the Rio+20 meeting. It wasn't. They tout it as being a raving success, but others say it wasn't. It was a failure. However, they're still going ahead. ICLEI is still going ahead and signing up local governments. That's where the problem is. Not so much their conference, but what they're doing on a daily basis.
So they're sending in their trained personnel as the so-called experts, is how I usually would say it, and in convincing these various agencies, or municipalities, governments, into going along with this their agenda, even though they change the names often, so they don't even recognize where all this is coming from.
Right, that's one of their tactics, is to change the names. In fact, they've changed their name. ICLEI is called something else now. I don't even really know what it's... Okay, it's now called Local Governments for Sustainability. But it's still ICLEI.
Mm-hmm.
And, here's a good example. I was called by a group from Merced County, California, and Merced City had just signed an agreement with ICLEI. And so I looked up their documents, and this was in late 2010, and it's called the Merced Vision 2015 General Plan, and then the City of Merced Action Plan Background Report. It was all created by ICLEI, and it's also called a Climate Action Plan. And one of the things that really interested me in reading that plan is that they were really enthusiastic in touting what they call loft housing. Now, just picture what loft housing must mean. Talk about the epitome of high-density housing. You're supposed to enjoy living in a loft. But that's what they had in Merced City, and they were touting that and all these changing cars to bicycles. It's right down the line, Smart Growth Agenda 21.
Well, you know, I've done several interviews with Shu Bartholomew. I don't know if you're familiar with her or not, but she's worked with these HOAs and condo associations, and she'd been over 20 years dealing with them, which is what happens when these people go into these loft or associations. It's somebody else telling you how to live. And she said there's nothing in it for the people. These are designed to for the betterment of something else, but it isn't for the people and the owners.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, who is going to want to live in a cubicle and enjoy it? I mean, it's the high up leaders that are telling people this is going to be great for you, and this is, but it's not. I mean, people aren't certainly they can't be buying that. I can't imagine somebody looking at this new idea of housing and saying, "You want me to? I'm supposed to like this?" And I just, "Oh, that this looks great." I mean, I can't imagine anybody saying that. I mean, that would be ridiculous. So how are they going to get people to engage or to accept that kind of high-density, shoulder-to-shoulder living quarters?
Well, they guilt them to do it for one way to do it. I mean, because when you look back in some of the old pictures, motion pictures or pictures of from Hollywood of what, like, New York City or one of these large cities was like, I mean, it was bumper-to-bumper people everywhere, let alone horses or buggies or you name it. And they had to, you know, they had high-density housing then. It really, you know, it doesn't have that many advantages, even though they pass it off like it does.
Right. Yeah, there are no advantages. And this is where it is going to really impact and distress the people who live in rural communities now, like I do, and I guess I don't know if you do, but that if they succeed in squeezing out the people from the rural communities into the cities, of course there's going to be plenty of unhappy people. It's just people, you know, when I grew up, the dream of everybody that I went to college with was to work in the cities for a while, find a place in the country to retire or to move into later when you could afford it. Well, that's opposite of the ICLEI agenda.
And there's a lot of people that, you know, love living in cities, and that, you know, that, but they have that choice. But once you don't have that choice, there are those that don't want to live there. And when you start shoving people into parks in national parks and shutting down the smaller ones and so they don't have the bleed off from these places, then you go camping, you may as well be in the city. I mean, you're on top of each other. Again, there's people that love that, but then there's a lot of people that don't.
There are some people who love that, who like the cities, but the people I associated with when I did live in the city I would say the majority of them, their dream was to get out of the city. It was my dream to get out of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally did it, but and others I know eventually did as well. And I'm not saying that everybody should move out of the cities. If they like it in the cities, they should have that option. But they shouldn't be dictated that they have to live in a cubicle. Because even in a city, you can have some elbow room. It depends on what you want to do. But if you're forced into a certain kind of housing, that's not.
And what happens when that takes place, it drives the cost of living there way up.
Well, it certainly does.
You know, I was hoping maybe we could talk a little bit about heritage areas. What is your understanding about them and what's behind them?
Right. Well, the UN Heritage Conference, or whatever it was called way back when, Heritage Sites, it's the World Heritage Conference, I believe, and they created the World Heritage Sites. They've added to the list as the years went on, but one of the first ones that they they added was Yellowstone National Park. And the story that I found kind of fascinating not so many years ago was that all of a sudden the Yellowstone National Park was named a World Heritage Site in danger, and found out the reason was that 80 miles from the World Heritage Site, Yellowstone Park, was a proposed gold mine. By naming it the World Heritage Site in danger, they stopped the gold mine. Well, the thing about the World Heritage Sites is that the government, which of course the UN calls the state, when they sign, they have to sign an agreement that a site become listed on their World Heritage Sites list. And once they do that, then they have to adhere to these restrictions on what can be done in those areas. And there's a whole long list. I don't have the list in front of me, but I have seen quite some time ago, I created a list of all of these World Heritage Sites in the United States. Glacier National Park.
Grand Canyon.
Park, and there's another park up here in northwestern Montana, Everglades National Park.
Grand Canyon, right?
Pardon me?
In the Grand Canyon?
Let's see. Is the Grand Canyon on the list? That's a good...
I'm pretty sure it is.
Could be.
Yeah,
I'm sure about the Grand Canyon.
But as that happens, when they become these kind of World Heritage Areas, then what can be done with them and how they're utilized goes into, you know, again, with UN control and not federal control.
Right. The federal control is lost. they enter into an agreement. I've read their documents as to what that means. And I think this is something that the average person that hasn't done the research doesn't understand, that they will say, oh, well, so what? So what's named a World Heritage Site? That's just the name. Well, it never is just the name. I've heard people say that. Well, it's just a name. It's not just a name. There is if you look hard enough, you will find an agreement behind that name. That agreement releases control to the United Nations in every case.
And so
they receive money, okay? The state, that is the United States in this case, has to pay money to the UN for that. so they're funded through that, and there are all kinds of restrictions. And then the UN body can, at a moment's notice, anytime they want to, can declare it an in danger site. And that's where the restrictions really get heavy. And they include more than just the site itself.
Okay, now how are you familiar with any of these areas like the Sangre de Cristo heritage area? I think Park County, Colorado, is under some kind of a heritage area. What would be their purpose in naming these and putting them in that designation? Are you familiar with that?
Those specific ones, no, but the reason that I think that they would be wanting to do that is that they want the United Nations mission is to control as much of the world as possible. If they can do it piece by piece, that's fine. They'll do that. If they can do it by acquiring a whole country, they'll do that. They'll do it any way they can to acquire control. They don't really care, I suppose, who lives on it, as long as they have control over it.
So does the UN control the Nature Conservancy?
That I don't know. I haven't looked into the connection between the UN and Nature Conservancy. That would be a good project to undertake.
Well, since they seem to be acquiring land, and you're saying that the UN wants to acquire land, I would see that would be a logical thought to look at, logical way to connect them. But
right, and I have heard, I haven't verified this, but I've heard that that the Nature Conservancy does own land in other countries. So,
oh, I know it does. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, some of the researchers I'm familiar with have followed through on, and then you have people like, and I brought this up before about Hank Paulson being on the board of governors or board of directors. He's been, you know, I see different names there, and which, you know, some people might think that, you know, this guy, you know, is worthy of that, but then, you know, when you see what happens to our economy with him being the secretary of, I believe, the secretary of the treasury and being head of Goldman Sachs and walking away with all kinds of money that, you know, and promises that they've made. Do we want our, you know, world lands, you know, under his control?
Right.
So I, you know, it's just questions. All I'm, you know, and that's my purpose in bringing someone like you, Ron, on the program is, you know, we just need to ask questions. And if we want to get involved, there's plenty out there to get involved with.
Right. There's so much to get involved with, and it can be overwhelming. So a person, I don't think anybody can be an expert in all of these areas at the same time. There's just no way. If you find a focus that interests you and you research that out thoroughly, I think that's great. And then you should share your knowledge with the rest of the world. And what I looked for, I really decided that dealing with the local, layer of government is where I wanted to be, because I felt the federal government was too far gone out of control, and I had so little influence on it, it wouldn't make any difference. So, and the state government is not much better, it's a little better. But at the local level is where the difference can be made. And besides, there is the old philosophy that all government is local. And that's the way our Constitution is set up. So that's why I'm so interested in helping local governments exercise their proper and legal authority to have a say in the federal government. That's the only way it's being held back, if at all.
Well, if we don't do that and do that beginning now, there won't be a constitution to even be, you know, standing up for, because their intent is to pretty much, you know, make a universal control around the world, and and to pass it off as an environmental thing or global warming issue or whatever, and yet you have countries that get a pass, free pass, like China, Singapore, and places where they're just industrializing them like crazy, and because they consider them a developing country, so they don't have to worry about what they pollute. And then they can ship all that stuff back over here and bypass all those laws.
That's right. It's all in the name of making a few more dollars for the big corporation.
Yeah, and so, but in the meantime, you know, their intent is to bring us down to third world status so that we don't have the jobs, we don't have the incomes, and the jobs market creation is pretty much in government, bureaucracy.
That's right, and the way we get the populace interested in the coordination aspect is because we are able to say that this is the way that we can create the jobs and the economy is through coordination. Otherwise, I mean, we see the evidence that jobs and the economy have gone downhill because of the inavailability of the access to the resources that created the jobs that we used to have.
Okay, let me bring up one more thing before we try to bring this to a close, and this is KATNLP 106.9 Salida. So one of the things that I always hear, it doesn't matter what is being proposed, it's always going to create jobs. It's always going to create jobs, and they always try to push that sale, and I watched it with a water company come through our area who did that, and I'm talking to the workers that had jobs created by, you know, supposedly by that, and you couldn't, the shenanigans that these employers can do to, you know, yeah, they're you know, abiding by their agreement, but when you see how they're abiding by it, you really have to wonder. And they sign off and everybody goes their way, but maybe they need to look a little deeper on what happens after that, because sometimes these companies, you know, they don't like to be told what to do.
No. Well, we get to the root of the problem, and in our area here, it's pretty obvious that the job base historically was the public lands resources, the forest products and mining were the two biggest ones, as well as some other side ventures, but centered around those where all the jobs came from. So when the forest is closed down, you don't have access to those resources, mm-hmm. The jobs here. And so what we're going at the root of the problem, and we don't care what company it is that comes in and says, if you gain us access to the forest again, we'll be here to produce jobs. That's what we're aiming at is we have had companies come to us and say, we'd like to do this project. And then we ask them, well, what do you need to do it? Well, we need wood. And then we ask them, do you have a guarantee from the Forest Service that you'll be able to get the wood? And they say, well, no, we don't, but we think we will. So we tell them that the Forest Service has told us in no uncertain terms that they will not guarantee anybody any resource out of the forest. So we report that back to them, and they run. They won't come here. So what we're trying to do is get the Forest Service to say, yes, we will allow you to use the resources that are in our custody.
Okay, but that has to be through ones other than wilderness areas, right?
Oh, yeah, plenty of areas that are not wilderness. But that's why we're also putting the brakes on the expansion of wilderness. What we say is enough wilderness already. We have enough wilderness, no more wilderness. We have wilderness proposals all around us, but they're not going forward. And I don't know if it's because we're resisting them, but that's probably partially it. But people are just tired of this wilderness expansion.
Well,
we've got to stop the wilderness expansion, but that's not where we're going to stop. We need to then continue on to increase the harvest from the forest.
Okay, and so if you take something like a national monument or whatever, whose tax base does that go into?
Whose tax base? Well, it comes,
does that go into national, does it into the federal, or does that go into the area that it's developed?
My understanding is, the proposal is that it would come off of the, come away from, if there's any private land that's influenced, of course, or taken over by that, then that tax base would be lost to the county, or the city. And that's where the danger is in these monuments, is that they don't just apply to the particular small piece of land. Like in the case of the San Juan Islands, the map is drawn all around the islands, and it looks like, they haven't admitted it yet, but they're close to having to admit that that's going to include all of the islands, which includes a lot of private property.
Which will restrict the property owner's rights.
Yeah, it will eventually cause people to just have to leave because...
They can't sell it.
Can't sell it. They can't do anything with it if it's a part of a national monument.
And that's an acquisition that they don't even have to give them remuneration for, or do they?
Well, that's an up-in-the-air question always is when is it a taking, and how can the federal agency weasel out of the takings? They have all kinds of theories and ways that they say, oh, it's not a taking. Well, usually then it has to end up in court, and it certainly would end up in court, but that's why in the San Juan Islands, they're not going to sit by and allow that monument to be inclusive of all this private property. That's why they're invoking the coordination process and dealing with the BLM on that. So we'll see what happens with that.
Okay. Well, you know, Ron, I really appreciate you coming on the program and offering your help. Again, you want to give your phone number and email in case somebody wants to contact you in regarding to coordination?
Sure. It's 406-396-0022, phone number. And my email address is rolfert@blackfoot.net.
And again, I thank you again. And did you want to mention anything more about Trademark America?
It's a good site that has information about coordination and different reports on it of coordination activities across the nation. It has a lot of information there. It would be a good site to refer to. It's trademarkamerica.org. It's all one word. Just go and take a look at that site.
Again, and I thank you again, and we'll have to do this again. So.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
It's been great talking to you.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.